less than 20% of the kids who need mental health treatment in the United States receive mental health treatment, and a very, very small fraction of those kids who actually get care receive evidence-based care. So I think training's super fun, and it really fits with my sort of mission and goal as a psychologist to disseminate high-quality practices as broadly as possible.
Hello and welcome to Preoccupied. Today we're talking with Dr. Sarah Tannenbaum. She's the Associate Director of Camp Baker at the Judge Baker Children's Center and also a staff psychologist at their Center for Effective Child Therapy.
So Judge Baker Children's Center is a nonprofit organization, and they aim to serve children and their families by supporting children's developmental, emotional, and intellectual well-being. And under that umbrella exists Camp Baker, which Dr. Tannenbaum is an associate director of, as Zenon just mentioned.
Yeah, and Maddie, I think you have some experience there, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got to work as an undergraduate counselor at Camp Baker last summer, and it was an awesome training experience. And the things that I learned are going to stay with me as a clinician for forever. And the kids were super-duper cute. So Camp Baker is a six-week day camp that teaches kids from 6 to 12 how to effectively manage the symptoms of their ADHD and the kind of implications of those symptoms. So things like building social skills, building gross motor skills, teamwork, and a lot of accountability.
So then, Maddie, is this just for kids with ADHD, or are there also other disorders that are under treatment at Camp Baker?
Well, I do believe that a diagnosis of ADHD is required to be able to attend the camp, but ADHD is also has a high rate of comorbidity, which basically means that it's one person who has two or more of the same disorders happening at the same time. And sometimes it can kind of feed into each other. And this makes diagnosing and treating disorders a lot more complicated, this idea of comorbidity.
Yeah, and we see that ADHD tends to be comorbid with something else at a rate between 60 and 80%, which is crazy high.
Yeah, that's like to the point of like a lot of practitioners, when they see someone with ADHD, will assume that they have comorbidity with another disorder.
Yeah, and the disorders we see here are things like generalized anxiety disorder or oppositional defiant disorder or some kind of substance use disorder.
Yeah, and obviously the consequences of these disorders can be pretty serious. I mean, especially with oppositional defiance, which is exactly what it sounds like, you'll see higher rates of dropping out of school or ending up within the prison system. So these treatment programs that try to intercept with these like behavioral manifestations of these disorders are crucial for the success of these children later on in life.
Yeah, and then there are even some other symptoms of ADHD that aren't quite as well known, like trouble sleeping, just difficulty learning in general.
Yeah, and something I learned over this summer actually was like, I mentioned a little bit, like gross motor skills, like playing sports and things like that, which I thought was kind of counterintuitive because I feel like we have this, you know, idea, this ill-informed idea of what ADHD looks like, which is like, oh, energetic, like, you know, fast and excited. And you think, oh, well, they must be really gifted at sports, at using their bodies, you know, but sometimes that can be really difficult.
So early interventions like Camp Baker are really important when it comes to making sure that these symptoms don't carry on into being very disruptive in adulthood and causing a lot of dysfunction.
Yeah.
So aside from her work at Camp Baker, Dr. Tannenbaum also treats individual children throughout the year. And one of the techniques that she uses here and that we talk about a bit during the interview is Match ADTC. So Maddie, why don't you tell us a bit about Match?
So MATCH is short for Modular Approach to Therapy for Children. And then there's like a little second part that says with anxiety, depression, trauma, or conduct problems.
Yep. And that's where we get MATCH ADTC.
Yes. But we're just going to go with MATCH for short. And it's designed to be family focused and strength based. And it's made to be able to address a lot of the common elements around a lot of childhood emotional and behavioral problems like anxiety, depression, trauma, and conduct problems.
So when we're talking about psychological problems during childhood, we generally categorize those into two categories, internalizing disorders and externalizing disorders. So the first three that you hear about here, anxiety, depression, and trauma, tend to be a lot of internalizing type stuff, although trauma can also be externalizing in some cases. So we describe a disorder as internalizing when its effects are mainly on the child's own sort of cognition and emotional well-being. Whereas externalizing disorders, like conduct problems, oppositional defiant disorder, a lot of ADHD symptoms, for example, will be directed outwards and end up being disruptive towards others as well as towards the child themselves.
So what does MATCH look like in practice? Well, first, the therapist, child, and their family will all meet to identify the main goals for the child. Like, where are they struggling most?
Yeah, so like, what specific problems are they trying to improve? And then that sort of leads into the next step, in which there's sort of an algorithm or flow chart that's used to determine which modules are used to treat this child and attain their goals.
Right, and modules in this context is just pretty much like, kind of treatment methods, I guess. One module that a therapist might use when trying to help a family with an externalizing child meet their goals is active ignoring. And this is something that we used at Camp Baker a lot, which is when a child is doing a behavior that might make you upset or be disruptive, instead of rewarding that behavior with attention or even like one-on-one time, you just completely ignore that behavior. And this might seem kind of counterintuitive to some parents especially, but it actually can quickly stop a lot of the problem behaviors that children learn. Of course, active ignoring does not apply to violent behaviors against a child's self or the people around them.
Yeah, and while a lot of these treatment techniques might sound kind of common sense, the really neat thing about MATCH ADTC is that all of these modules are evidence-based. So they've all been tested scientifically rigorously to make sure that they work, and they're all based on sort of a theoretical background. So another module that we see for children with internalizing issues, and this one comes more out of a cognitive behavioral therapy sort of theory that you might be familiar with if you listen to our interviews with Ms. Broadwater a few episodes ago. And that module is called Changing Blue Thoughts. So blue here is an acronym for blaming myself, looking for the bad news, unhappy guessing, and exaggerating. And these are sort of renaming some aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy to make a nice acronym that a kid can remember, right? And to put it in simple terms. So for example, in a normal cognitive behavioral therapy setting, we would use the term catastrophizing instead of exaggerating, which is thinking about a situation and making it something even worse than it is just by elaborating off of it and thinking about what the worst is that could possibly happen. So this sort of module focuses on helping the child identify thoughts that are perhaps unreasonably negative and not representative of reality, and then helping that child learn ways to adapt those. And then aside from MATCH ADTC, another technique that Dr. Tenenbaum uses is parent-child interaction therapy, or PCIT. And with that, what happens is the parent and the child come in and sort of have a consultation with the therapist, and they talk about what problems is the child having, and how can those problems be addressed, right? And it starts off with the parent and the child just interacting with each other, as parent-child interaction therapy would suggest, while the therapist is on the other side of a one-way mirror and observing. And it starts off with just the therapist observing to get an idea of sort of what behaviors are going on between the parent and the child. And then the parent will wear something like a Bluetooth earpiece and receive real-time feedback from the therapist about what they can be doing better to interact in a more constructive way with their child. There's even some interesting research out about delivery of PCIT online, which is a very novel idea in that field because, as we've talked about before, online therapy on its own is a very novel technique that's still sort of gaining traction within the field. But online PCIT, there are some studies showing that it can still be effective when the therapist's interaction is limited to through a video feed into someone's home. And that has better ecological validity, right? Which is a thing we talk about in psychology where the surroundings and the circumstances of the behavior are closer to what it would be like in real life. So
it might be easier to learn these techniques as a parent when you're at home where you do find that you're requesting things of your child, you're playing with your child rather than in a new environment. So it might be easier to generalize those skills to other parts of your life and to other settings.
Exactly, yeah. And the therapist can even make more specific and precise suggestions to the parent that are going to be more applicable to everyday life because the therapist sees how the parent and the child interact in their environment rather than in the artificial environment of the office. But we're going to get to hear more about that when we talk to Dr. Tannenbaum. So let's head to that interview.
So we're here with Dr. Sarah Tannenbaum of Judge Baker's Children's Center in Boston. Dr. Tannenbaum, could you briefly describe your background and education for us?
Sure. So I got my bachelor's in psychology from Northeastern. I actually thought that I wanted to be an applied behavioral analyst. So I really focused on that in undergrad and had some clinical experiences that deterred me and made me want to become a clinical psychologist. So I pursued a doctoral degree at William James College in clinical psychology. I did an internship at Riverbend Community Mental Health in Concord, New Hampshire, in early childhood trauma and autism spectrum disorders. And then I went to Judge Baker Children's Center, which is a Harvard Med School affiliate organization for my postdoctoral fellowship in evidence-based practices, and I got hired on as a staff member, and I've been there ever since.
You've had a very broad range of experiences. So what drew you to psychology as an undergraduate when you were looking at different majors, trying out different classes?
Yeah, I actually switched majors maybe 1 million times. I thought I was going to do poli-sci, then I thought I was going to go pre-law, then I did journalism for a little bit, and I was actually in a pre-law class that was on law and psychology, and I found that I was way more interested in the psychology side of things, and that's when I switched majors.
Definitely interesting how those intersect. So got the bug for psychology, then what drew you to work with the population that you work with, which now is mainly children, things like that?
I've always loved kids and working with kids, and I did a lot of volunteer work when I was in high school and did a lot of babysitting, things like that. So I think I was always drawn to working with kids. When I was in undergrad and I decided to specialize in psychology for my major, I found behavioral therapies and theories, and I was really drawn to those kinds of approaches. The biggest approach that I was drawn to in undergrad was behavior modification, and I thought I really wanted to work with children on the autism spectrum. I still do work with kids on the autism spectrum, but as I mentioned earlier, I had thought I wanted to do more of a applied behavior analysis route, so I got experience working with really, really severe autism spectrum and other developmental delays. And that was not really what was for me. Part of my doctoral training even though I knew I wanted to work with kids and families, they made me do generalist training before I specialized. So I was able to go in and say kids and families is my primary concentration area, but they forced me to have some experiences working with adults, which ended up being really invaluable experiences. And I think all of my different clinical training throughout grad school, what I experienced in undergrad, and my coursework really helped me hone in on working with children and their families. I particularly really like working with young children through a prevention lens, because I think if we can get in and address the problems using evidence-based practices as early as possible, we have the greatest ability to affect a larger amount of change.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear you talk about the doctoral program. It sounds almost like a similar model to a lot of undergraduate universities where people do a general education and then specialize. So a question we kind of have regarding that is, what is it that led you to that doctorate program and a doctor of psychology as opposed to a PhD?
Honestly, it was not knowing. I was 23 and I had no clue what I wanted to do. I didn't really know anyone in the field. I knew I didn't want to go the ABA route. I had sort of seen psychologists in other places that I worked and said, oh, I kind of want to do what they're doing. And I, you know, lived with my boyfriend in Massachusetts, and we decided we wanted to stay in Massachusetts. So it really limited my search for doctoral programs. I had one family friend who was a psychologist, and she told me, it doesn't matter what degree you get, everyone takes the same test. PhD, PsyD doesn't really matter. So I went in a little blind. I applied to both PhD and PsyD programs. I got in mostly to the master's programs of the PhD programs, and they said, you know, if your grades are good enough, if you're a good enough student, we'll help you matriculate into a doctoral program. And I just didn't know enough then about the difference. So when I got into a PsyD program, I said, well, I know I want to be a psychologist anyway, so let me just kind of shortcut and go right in instead of doing a master's.
In a way, it's kind of nice to be able to narrow the scope that way. You know, there's just so many options over the nation. In a way, it's nice to know where you want to live, where you want to practice, how, and just go from there and see what opportunities present themselves. Clearly,
yeah,
I think I might
have done things differently if I had known. I might have done things differently. Sometimes I would have gone to a program, but I definitely don't want to go back to school, so that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Could you give us a little bit more detail on where you've practiced since finishing that doctorate and how that's influenced what you do today?
Honestly, I've only practiced one place since I formally finished my doctorate degree, because I did my postdoctoral training at Judge Baker, and that's where I've stayed. So most of the variation in my experience was prior to finishing my doctorate degree, but I think really, you know, part of why I liked the PsyD program and I chose that route is because I really like when what I'm doing clinically aligns with what I'm learning in school. And I went to Northeastern, where they have something called a co-op program, and you get some practical experience. And I learned that that's a really good way for me to learn. And in my program, I started clinical work day one, just like when I started classes. You know, I think over the course of my broad training, I really felt like when I was at different training sites that didn't have a theoretical orientation or approach that they used, I felt a little bit like I was grasping for straws. I wasn't really sure what to do or how to proceed with things, or are the other people here doing good work? Am I doing good work? It's really hard to know, because mental health problems are complex and they interface in a lot of different areas and domains and settings. Is a kid getting better? And I worked with really complex problem areas pretty much all through grad school and after grad school. So again, you know, you can get better, and kids can get better in some areas or even get worse in other areas. And that really drove me to seek out more explicit training in evidence-based practices, which is why I chose my postdoctoral fellowship at Judge Baker, which is a leading organization across both the nation and the world in developing and disseminating evidence-based practices. And so that's why I chose Judge Baker for my postdoc, and that's why I've stayed at Judge Baker as a practicing psychologist.
I totally hear you. It's one thing to be a part of that development, but then to actually see it applied would be something really special.
Yeah, and we do really large systems work at Judge Baker. So part of what I love about my role there is I have the ability to really interface with kids and families on a lot of levels at Judge Baker. I get to do direct patient care. I get to run a program with a larger number of kids and families and supervise emerging clinicians. And then I'm involved with some statewide initiatives where we are brought in by the State Department of Public Health and tasked with training their workforce. So we go in and we train already licensed clinicians in what the best evidence-based practices are. So that allows me to feel connected to the work because I still have some patients who are mine, who I meet with on a weekly basis in sort of traditional outpatient psychotherapy, but I also have an impact within the state of Massachusetts and more broadly across the country, which I think is really, really cool and part of what gives my work at Judge Baker a lot of meaning.
So it sounds like you have the opportunity to advocate for evidence-based practices, both at this more institutional level and also in the more interpersonal level with training and with your own clients. So speaking of your clients, what kind of clientele do you treat?
So we work with all sorts of problem areas at Judge Baker. I particularly like working with children under 6 years old, again, because I really love the prevention aspect. But my youngest kid right now is 3 years old and my oldest is 19. And the primary areas of the kids that I treat are anxiety, depression, trauma, and disruptive behavior disorder.
It sounds like the common thread across all these different things that you do is these evidence-based practices. Are most of your interventions cognitive behavioral, or what kind of theory do you follow?
Yeah, most of the approaches that we use at Judge Baker are a primary cognitive behavioral or behavioral approach that have been well validated in the research literature.
What are some of the methods that you use to treat your clients? We saw some interesting acronyms listed on your webpage, like CBT, DBT, CPP, MATCH, ADTC, PCIT. These are the kind of things we're kind of curious about.
Yeah, a lot of mouthfuls there.
Yes, so psychology is a field filled with acronyms, and the sort of cognitive behavioral evidence-based practice world is, really turns it up a notch with acronyms. So at Judge Baker, where I work, our former CEO and president, John Weiss, developed the MATCH ADTC approach with his colleague, Bruce Torpeda, who's at UCLA. So they are leading researchers in the field of child clinical psychology. And what MATCH is, it stands for a modular approach to treating childhood disorders. So it's actually a treatment where you can address problems with trauma, anxiety, depression, and conduct problems all within one overarching treatment manual. So at Judge Baker, yes, so you could use one model to treat about 70%. One model treats 70% of the problems that we see in typical outpatient therapy.
So that's like that's the primary tool.
Yeah, so that was developed at Judge Baker, so it's something that we use a lot. I am a trained therapist in the MATCH protocol. I'm also a supervisor and a trainer in MATCH. So when we go out to states, we train other clinicians in how to use MATCH. The other primary approach in our outpatient clinic is parent-child interaction therapy, or PCIT.
Okay, now I heard a bit about this over the summer, but What does that look like if we were to eavesdrop on a session?
So parent-child interaction therapy is an evidence-based treatment approach for kids ages 2 to 7 years old with externalizing behavior problems. Part of what is wonderful about PCIT is that there is a live coaching component. So when caregivers and their kids come in, I actually spend very little time with the child. I never spend time with the child one-on-one. And really, we look at the parent of the agent of as the agent of change because they're the most important person in the child's life, the person who's going to be there with them through all the ups and downs of child rearing. When we do PCIT, we do a brief check-in with parents. We look at how the week was. We review homework practice because homework practice is a big part of any cognitive behavioral approach. If families are not practicing at home, it's very unlikely they're going to get better in just 1 hour a week of psychotherapy. And after we do that check-in and we've reviewed homework and how the week has been, we give parents something we call a bug in the ear, which is essentially a Bluetooth headset. And they wear the Bluetooth headset or the hearing aid, whatever technology you have at your, you know, respective location. And I go back behind a one-way mirror in the observation room and I coach the parents on how to interact with their child in a more appropriate, positive, pro-social way. I'm literally in their head. Really,
so it focuses a lot on equipping parents to better interact with their children outside of therapy then.
Yeah, so both they learn the skills within therapy and then they learn how to apply and generalize the skills to other environments.
The other method that we saw on your webpage that we thought was kind of interesting is dialectical behavior therapy. Do you use that a lot?
So I'm not certified in DBT. I had some training in DBT at different places that I worked during my graduate education, but I'm not a certified DBT therapist. Sometimes I draw from DBT when I have kids with more significant emotion dysregulation, distress tolerance issues such as suicidality or other kinds of interpersonal difficulties.
So using things like PCIT, that's just like a fraction of your job. And Camp Baker from this summer, which we talk a bit about in our intro, that's all just, I remember you telling me, this is just 20% of my job. And I was like, holy crap. So what does a day in the life of Dr. Sarah look like?
I think part of what I really like about being a psychologist is that there is no regular day in the life. Every day looks a little different. Most days I have some patient contact. I have lots of administrative meetings and paperwork that I have to do. I get to do some research and prep for poster presentations, publication, manuscript preparation, and I do a lot of consultation. You know, depending on the time of year, I'm either running a camp program or I'm getting ready for the camp program or I'm speaking with outside providers, with school districts, with media. So lots of different things go into making my day. And I also am part of the internship training faculty at Judge Baker. So I do a lot of supervision and a lot of teaching.
Oh, okay. So you have a lot of different aspects, a lot of skills you get to use within your job. You are teaching, you're interacting with clients, you're doing administrative things. What part of your day is the most fun for you?
I guess it kind of depends. When client sessions go well, they're very fun in the morning. That's not always the case. I think training and supervision are some of the things that I really love to do. I love having the young brains who are eager to learn and really active and curious that I'm helping to foster and develop. I also really love training people in evidence-based practices. Less than 20% of the kids who need mental health treatment in the United States receive mental health treatment, and a very, very small fraction of those kids who actually get care receive evidence-based care. So I think training super fun, and it really fits with my sort of mission and goal as a psychologist to disseminate high quality practices as broadly as possible.
So then with all these different things that you do, it must be some really long work days. What are some ways that you practice self-care?
So I think we are a field where we practice, but we preach, but we don't always practice what we preach. For me, my days are really long, and it's hard to find self-care opportunities. I think it's something you really have to carve out early on, because life just gets more complicated and more busy. Exercise is probably the biggest thing for me. I am a regular exerciser. I go into work late in the morning. I work late evenings, so most of the time I don't show up at work until about 10, so I can get, you know, a workout class or a run in before I head to work. And then I think just hang out with friends, hang out with my partner, making fun things to do on the weekends, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so really interesting how before your day even starts, you start off on the right foot, do a little something for Dr. Tannenbaum, and then you're ready to take on the day. So how do you feel the field of child psychology has changed in the last 50 years or so?
Well, I haven't been around for 50 years.
Right. Obviously not.
You know, I think, especially the child psychology field, I think it barely existed maybe 50 years ago. I think we used to look at kids as little adults. And I think more and more each day we are understanding that children are not little adults and that their brains and bodies and experiences are unique to them as children. Interestingly, we've had the cognitive behavioral approaches for about 50 years. So these things have been shown to work for a long, long period of time. But what we haven't spent as much time focusing on is how to disseminate those practices more broadly. And so I think that's an exciting area that the field is going into. Instead of creating more evidence-based practices, just, you know, different acronym, different researcher, but essentially the same practice, taking what we know works and making sure that it's more broadly available. There's now really exciting initial preliminary data about telemental health. So, for instance, ECIT has an internet component. So they're studying internet PCIT, which has really strong preliminary evidence and empirical support. So I think that is a big way that our field is changing. And I think there's a lot of controversy around that. You know, there's a lot of discussion around how social media maybe is making mental health problems worse. But also, are there ways that technology can enhance mental health treatment by reducing barriers, such as stigma of going into a clinic, transportation barriers of actually getting to a clinic, and then, of course, people who live in rural areas where there aren't providers, now they can log on to their computer at home and they can seek high-quality treatment. So I think those are a lot of trends that are really exciting in our field.
Absolutely. It's one thing to have all of this valuable information. It's another thing when it's taking, you know, decades to reach the public. So I definitely really love that about Judge Baker as well. It's like this mission to serve the community with this, especially with technology.
Yeah.
The accessibility is so exciting.
All right. And with all of this research in psychology, and as we learn more and more, it really starts to inform kind of how we view things. So then for you personally, how has studying and practicing psychology influenced how you view other people and the world?
I think at this point, it's hard to distinguish how I view things as a psychologist from how I view things as a human, because it's just sort of a part of who I am. I think obviously, mental health is really important to me, so I look at almost all the world's problems through a mental health lens and perspective. I think I also look at problems again, through that prevention perspective, rather than sort of focusing on things when they get really, really big, focusing on them when they're smaller and more manageable so we can have a bigger impact. And I think mental health really touches almost every aspect of our worlds. You know, a lot of my friends call me and say, hey, how do I handle this? Or what do you think about this? So, you know, and really about things that might not appear to be mental health related. Some of the things I've been doing more recently are giving talks to different schools or parent organizations about how to limit screen time. You know, using screen time is not a mental health problem. It's an all-child problem and all-parent problem. So I think really thinking about how to take some of the training that I have in specific mental health issues and expanding it to how to approach life and problems more generally.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely like the more we learn in our classes, it's hard to look at your relationship conflicts or what careers you're looking at, how you relate to your friends and your family. Like it's suddenly you have this entirely new lens, and it can be really helpful sometimes. And other times it's hard to just turn it off, for sure. So our final question, my favorite question personally, what advice would you have for undergraduate students who want to do what you do someday?
What advice do I have? I would say slow down. There is no rush. I think that if I had known what I know now, I would have probably taken more time off between undergrad and graduate school. I would have spoken to more people. I would have really figured out more of what I wanted to do. I would really say don't enter a doctoral program or a master's program, but especially a doctoral program if you're not 110% sure that it's what you want to do, because you don't want to enter and then question yourself, because you're going to question it anyway. Grad school is really hard. It's really demanding. When I think back about grad school and all the things that I had to do, I'm still kind of like, how did I do that? And it doesn't just end in grad school. You have your pre-doctoral internship training. You have your postdoctoral training. You have to write a dissertation. You have to take a horrible, horrible test. So if you really, you know, aren't sure, you know, lots of life stages happen when you're in grad school. Many of my friends got married, bought houses, started making a lot of money while I was still unpaid and overworked. And I'm still behind in a lot of those areas because I put my education and training first. And that can be really hard, and it can be really isolating when everyone in your life says, wait, you're still in school? I thought you were almost done. So you have to really know that it's what you want to do, and you have to also understand it's not a field where you're going to make a ton of money or where you're necessarily going to get a lot of thanks or appreciation. So you have to really be in it for more sort of intrinsic motivating reasons.
Right. You have to be disillusioned of the, oh, well, you know, they'll give me a stipend and I can just, oh, yeah, just do research all day. It'll be smooth sailing for sure. So, yeah, I remember this summer we talked quite a bit about, oh, if you just want that fancy title of doctor, like you might want to look at yourself a little bit longer.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely think I watched a lot of my friends and colleagues drop out of school. And some, it happened, we call it ABD, all but dissertation. You do not want to be the person who completes all of the doctoral training except getting your dissertation done. And then I have friends who finished their dissertation and did internship and did postdoc, and they still haven't passed their licensing exam, because they didn't prioritize it, or it's a really hard test. It's really expensive. So it's really a marathon. And even when you're first out of school, you barely have a livable wage, at least if you work in Boston, Massachusetts. So it's really the long haul, and you really have to have your eyes on the prize and know why you're doing it. And if you're in a relationship, you have to make sure that your partner is down to go through the journey with you. And if you're not in a relationship, you have to sort of be okay knowing that you probably won't be dating for a long time while you are in school, because there's just other things that are your top priority, and you can't be sort of the best partner that you can be when you're putting your time and attention into so many different things. So there's a lot of sacrifice that you make, and, you know, my partner and I have withstood it, but it really weighed a lot on our relationship, and I thought it was going to be 5 years going in, and it ended up being more like 7 years. So I think when I was kind of 23 and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and really green and excited, I had a really different perspective that wasn't totally grounded in reality. And as grad school went on, I had to find different mental tricks to keep myself in it and to get through. And I had to rely on my partner and my friends and advisors and mentors and other outlets, because it's really hard and grueling. And a lot of times you want to give up and quit. You got to really, really want to do it.
It sounds like you were lucky and you had that social support. Then we talk about this intrinsic motivation. What was the prize that your eye was on? What got you through late nights of writing papers and presenting and, oh, rent's due? Like, what got you through that? I could be a computer scientist, make $100,000 tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we spend billions and billions and billions of dollars as a society because of untreated mental health issues. And for me, once I found psychology, I really fell in love, and I wanted to be a part of changing that dollar amount and seeing the many, many, many people affected somewhat reduced in what I'm capable of doing. So I think, you know, knowing, you know, I grew up with a lot of resources. I grew up in an area that had, you know, a lot of respect for mental health, and none of the people that I grew up who, you know, were in therapy or accessed kind of the right kind of treatment, even in a really privileged environment that I grew up in. So I think I had a personal connection, and I sort of had this big question of, why is there this gap between science and practice? And how do I help reduce the gap?
All right, that's all we have for you. But thank you so much. I really appreciate your authenticity and your enthusiasm. You can just really tell that you love what you do. I'm really glad to have gotten to talk to you more in depth about that.
A huge thank you to Dr. Tannenbaum for talking with us about all of your experience working with children and PCIT and MATCH. We learned so much about what it's like to be a clinician working with children.
If you want to stay up to date as we release more episodes, make sure to give us a follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Leave us a rating or a review if you feel so inclined. Check out the description of the episode for Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, I believe.
Yeah,
right?
We're on Instagram now.
Yep. And our website, on which you can find a bunch of our episodes and a list of topics that we're looking for referrals on, if you know anyone who might be good for our podcast. So if you have any questions, concerns, comments, or just want to reach out, feel free to send us an email at hosts@pre-occupied.com.
See you next time. That could be in our little outtakes.
Brah.
Brah. Brah.
Brah.
All right.
We're practicing our best coronavirus spreading techniques.
Yeah, I know. This is super gross.
Yep.
Just spit everywhere.
Yes.